Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio. If you're listening to this broadcast on medium or shortwave in Europe or America, then this announcement is for you. As of July 1st, our programs will no longer be broadcast in these areas and on these frequencies. But they will still be available via satellite, on the internet, on demand and in podcast, and on local radio stations that rebroadcast them. For details, visit our website at vaticanradio.va.
Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and as always, at this time of week, I'm about to bring you our reflection on the Sunday Gospel, which will be followed by Joan Knows. Joan Lewis brings us a rundown of the Vatican Week. Let's begin then with Jill Bevilacqua's There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Stay tuned for the reading of the Gospel by Sean Patrick Lovett.
When Jesus had crossed back to the other side of the Sea of Galilee in the boat, a large crowd gathered around him, and he stayed close to the lake. One of the officials of the synagogue, a man named Jairus, came near. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and made this earnest appeal. "My little daughter is critically ill. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she may get well and live." The two went off together, and a large crowd followed, pushing against Jesus. People from the official's house arrived, saying, "Your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher further?" Jesus disregarded the report that had been brought and said to the official, "Fear is useless. What is needed is trust." He would not permit anyone to follow him except Peter, James, and James's brother, John. As they approached the house of the synagogue leader, Jesus was struck by the noise of people wailing and crying loudly on all sides. He entered and said to them, "Why do you make this din with your wailing? The child is not dead. She is asleep." At this they began to ridicule him. Then he put them all out. Jesus took the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child lay. Taking her hand, he said to her, "Talitha cum," which means, "Little girl, get up." The girl, a child of 12, stood up immediately and began to walk around. At this, the family's astonishment was complete. He enjoined them strictly not to let anyone know about it, and told them to give her something to eat.
Today's Gospel features one of the most familiar of our Lord's miracles, a much-recounted event. It can hardly be called an episode, which was, however, only one of a succession of miracles, of miraculous events or happenings, which took place on that extraordinary day. If, that is, we go by Mark's account. And as Mark was writing for Peter, we may take it, why not, for gospel. Jesus had been preaching since early morning from Peter's boat. And as evening approaches, he suggests they cross over to the other side of the lake, which they do. But exhausted as he doubtless was after a day's preaching, Jesus falls asleep almost immediately. For the next we hear is of a storm blowing up and the boat in danger of sinking. The terrified fishermen shake the sleeping Jesus awake, and in no time at all he has calmed the storm and his companions, who, filled with awe, as Mark recounts, say to one another, "Who can this be?" They've barely disembarked on the eastern side of the lake when a man with an unclean spirit appears. Indeed, with more than one, for he declares, "There are many of us." And as we know, in exchange for inhabiting the body of the man, the legion of demons beg Jesus to send them into a herd of pigs feeding on the mountainside. And all 2,000 of them hurtle down the cliff and plunge into the sea. The man is cured. But the disciples are given no time to recover from this second spectacular event, for the locals don't want this wonder worker to linger among them. And so, back across the lake they go. And, as we read in Luke,
on his return, Jesus was welcomed by the crowd, for they were all there waiting for him.
And Mark writes,
when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered round him, and he stayed by the lakeside.
And now the personality of today's gospel makes his appearance. A personality, clearly, for he's mentioned by name and described as one of the rulers of the synagogue, or, as in today's version, one of the officials, one of the heads of the synagogue elsewhere. Perhaps a large synagogue, as the one at Capernaum seems to have been, would have had more than one head. A biblical scholar explains.
Archisynagogos is a Greek title which was widespread among the Jews in Roman times and known also to the pagans. The head of the synagogue might be elected or nominated by an authority. In some cases, the post was hereditary. His role was that of spiritual and practical leader of the community. He it was who chose those persons charged with reading the law and reading the prayers. He saw to the building or restoration of the synagogue.
In a manual on daily life in Bible times, we read,
the chief function of the synagogue was to foster understanding and proper observance of the Jewish law. In effect, it became the seat of a spiritual government, which ordered and disciplined the lives of the people. Only certain persons were permitted to lead in worship.
The reading and the prayers in common were supervised by the ruler of the synagogue. The sermon might be given by a member of the congregation. And so, despite the late hour, for if we remember, Jesus and the disciples had gone across the lake when the day was already declining, despite this, the crowds are all around him. But then there's a murmur and a slight drawing back of those nearest to Jesus. Oh, look who it is! One can imagine the whispers going round. Matthew writes,
while he was speaking to them, up came one of the officials, who bowed low in front of him and said, my daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and her life will be saved. Jesus rose and with his disciples followed him.
In Mark's version, and similarly in Luke's, we read that the man came up, or came near, and, seeing Jesus, fell at his feet. In normal circumstances, a man of importance such as Jairus was would very probably have only bowed. But this man has a beloved daughter who is dangerously ill, if not already dead, and he is not going to stand on his dignity if there's the slightest chance that this stranger could save her life. And so, regardless of the people who, on seeing this august personage, have automatically made way for him, he throws himself at the feet of Jesus and pleads with him earnestly to come and lay his hands on her so that she may get well and live. In the various versions of Mark and Luke, the child is critically ill, desperately sick, at the point of death, dying. If for Matthew the girl was already dead, there would seem to be a discrepancy when we compare the accounts. But more probably he's less concerned with the details and development of the situation and goes straight to the climax, while including also another happening recounted by Mark and Luke. But first things first. What of Jairus? What kind of man is he? We're not told anything of him except what his words and actions reveal. A loving father in dire distress, fearful of losing his only daughter, as Luke tells us she was. Any man who loves or has loved a daughter will be able to understand this man's anguish. The relationship between father and daughter is a very special one. For a man, the birth of a daughter is a precious event. This fragile creature he holds in his arms, he knows to be only lent to him. For some day she will almost certainly belong to another man. But for now she is his own, and he formulates wishes, prayers, blessings, as these lines from A Prayer for My Daughter by W.B. Yeats.
May she be granted beauty, and yet not beauty to make a stranger's eye distraught, or hers before a looking glass, for such, being made beautiful overmuch, consider beauty a sufficient end. Lose natural kindness and maybe the heart-revealing intimacy that chooses right and never find a friend. In courtesy, I'd have her chiefly learned. Hearts are not had as a gift, but hearts are earned by those that are not entirely beautiful. May she become a flourishing hidden tree, that all her thoughts may like the linnet be, and have no business but dispensing round their magnanimities of sound. Or may she live like some green laurel, rooted in one dear perpetual place.
Looking through old family mementos, I came across a letter written by my father to my mother, enclosed in a box with a baby's gold bracelet. The occasion was, I think, my first birthday. This is what he wished for his daughter.
Health and happiness and the gift of making true friends, beauty and the sense of proportion to balance it, courage and a keen perception of humour to help her over the rough spots, loyalty and the charm that inspires devotion.
The letter ended with what he wished for most of all, that she would grow up with the qualities he loved most in her mother. And this is another aspect of what a father may feel for a daughter, a desire that she should reflect what he loves in her mother. Some of these thoughts surely passed through the mind of Jairus as he ran from his house in Capernaum down to the lake where the crowds were gathered, and where, someone said, the prophet from Nazareth had just stepped off a fisherman's boat. He had healed men and women, surely he would heal a child. And as he blurted out his frantic appeal, Jairus looked up into the eyes of Jesus and believed. No words were spoken by Jesus, there was no time to waste. He simply went with him, we read. The two went off together, today's version has it. And a large crowd followed, pushing against Jesus. Away from the lake now and up into the town of Capernaum, crowd following, pushing and shoving, trying to get closer and inevitably slowing progress. They were pressing all round him, almost stifling Jesus as he went, writes Luke. But before they're anywhere near the house of Jairus, there's an unexpected halt. A woman who has suffered from a hemorrhage for 12 years touches the cloak of Jesus and is instantly cured. "Who touched me?" exclaims Jesus, turning round. "You see how the crowd is pressing round you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" protest the disciples, reasonably enough. But Jesus continues to look round to see who it was, for, we read, he was immediately aware that power had gone out from him. The woman shows herself and tells her story. "Your faith has restored you to health," Jesus tells her. Not, he implies, the physical contact with his garment. The last thing he wants is to be taken for a magician. Knowing that he's needed at a deathbed, we might wonder why Jesus stops and talks to the woman when it seems that the miracle has taken place anyway. But it is evidently not to be kept secret. And there is a connection, write the scholars, between this extraordinary happening and the one which is to follow. Faith is the link between them. Faith will be the reason for the fourth miraculous event in this miracle-studded day. In his preaching that morning, writes the Bible scholar, Jesus had announced the coming of the kingdom in parables. The four miracles represent the power of the kingdom in action. Having dismissed the woman with a blessing, "Go in peace," Jesus is about to move on. For, clearly anxious, Jairus is probably already walking ahead. But there are people running towards them and shouting, and now they accost Jairus with devastating news. They have just come from his house.
"Your daughter has died. Do not trouble the master any further."
There must have been a moment's horrified silence, even from the crowd. And Jairus? We can imagine the effect of this brutal communication. But also surely a glance at the man in whom he has placed his trust. And that trust will not be betrayed, for Jesus has heard the news and hastens to reassure the distraught Jairus.
"Do not be afraid. Only have faith,"
writes a scholar.
Faith in Jesus must persist, even when there is no hope and all is over, humanly speaking. Then it is no longer enough to trust in a miracle-working healer, but in one who has the divine power of overcoming death.
Humanly speaking, Jairus must have had at least flickers of doubt, of despair. He must have felt the helplessness that every human being feels when unable to do anything to save the one he loves. Like the helpless grief in these lines from Charlotte Mew's poem, To a Child in Death.
You would have scoffed if we had told you yesterday. Love made us feel, or so it was with me, like some great bird, trying to hold and shelter you in its strong wing. A gay little shadowy smile would have tossed us back such a solemn word. And it was not for that you were listening, when so quietly you slipped away, with half the music of the world unheard. What shall we do with this strange summer meant for you? Dear, if we see the winter through, what shall be done with spring? This is the victory of the grave. Here is death's sting. That is not strong enough, our strongest wing.
Jairus held on to his hope, to his faith, and at last they reach his house. And Jesus now asserts his authority and refuses to allow anyone to follow him into the house except the three chosen disciples, Peter, James and John, and the child's parents. Jairus, of course, is with him anyway, and the mother must have been on the doorstep waiting, grieving, for her husband's return after what must seem to her to have been a fruitless mission. Everyone else, relations and professional mourners, as there no doubt were, is making a horrendous din, weeping and wailing unrestrainedly, writes Mark. Matthew mentions the flute players, and a note on the commotion tells us that this was the loud wailing of the Oriental mourner. Jesus immediately intervenes.
Why all this commotion and crying? The child is not dead, she's asleep. But they laughed at him, so he turned them all out.
One is reminded of the scene at the temple when he overturned the tables of the money changers and drove them out of his father's house. Here he is again in charge, and no one dares to challenge him.
And taking with him the child's father and mother and his own companions, he went into the place where the child lay.
The child. In the older versions, such as the Vulgate, we have maid and damsel, for the girl was 12 years old. And this, as the scholars remind us, was, for a girl, the moment of maturity. She was considered ready for marriage and to become a mother. This reported fact, together with the note that she was an only daughter, makes the prospect of death more dramatic. In the modern translations, however, the words child and little girl are used. Jairus himself refers to her as his little daughter. And so the final scene in this drama is played out, with Jesus taking the child by the hand and speaking the celebrated words, Little girl, I say to thee, arise. Talitha kum, or kumi, a word, we're told, still used by the Arabs for get up. Jesus, as we know, spoke in Aramaic, and Mark quotes him in this language on more than one occasion. Commenting on the declaration of Jesus that the child is not dead but is sleeping, the scholars write that, in the eyes of the evangelists, Jesus has come to transform death into a sleep from which he wakes us. The Greek verb for get up also means wake up, and transforms this miracle into a solemn sign of the resurrection. He reveals then his Easter power to give life beyond death. Talitha kumi, little girl, I tell you to get up. These words of Jesus are precious historical memory, writes one scholar. Finally, when the child gets up and walks about, to the amazement of all present, there is the ultimate touch of humanity in the recommendation that she be given something to eat. Two last thoughts from the scholars. First, remembering both Jairus and the woman with the hemorrhage.
Nearly always, the Lord worked his miracles because of the compassion which human suffering aroused in him.
Secondly, regarding his instruction that no one should be told what he had done.
From the beginning, Jesus did not desire to declare himself as Messiah, for that would have caused a popular movement or a political character. Later, he wished little by little to reveal himself to the people as the Son of God. For this reason, he ordered them not to let this miracle be known.
But Matthew concludes that the news spread all round the countryside.
And warm thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for this programme by the title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. She'll be back again at this same time next week. Meanwhile, time to join EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, Joan Lewis, who brings us the Vatican Week in review. Joan, a busy week.
A really incredible one, and it's going to be different next week because, of course, the Pope will be going to Castel Gandolfo for his summer vacation. No more general audiences in July, and the Angelus will be from Castel Gandolfo, and I think the first general audience then will be on August 1st. So
that's right.
For 4 weeks, we'll have it be kind of quiet, probably no press conferences, and there would be some nominations, which, of course, there was a flurry of nominations this week and appointments, but those are few and far between, but they still happen in the summer, and some of the interesting events did really occur over the weekend. We had the news of the Holy Father meeting with cardinals to discuss the VatiLeaks situation. And he does meet several times a year with the cardinals, the heads of the different dicasteries or offices in the Roman Curia. That's for usually curial business. But this time it was all about the leaks, of course, that confidential documents that over a period of months have been leaked from the Vatican. The Pope met with the head of the dicasteries, and then he met with a separate group of five cardinals: George Pell of Sydney, Mark Ouellette, prefect of the Congregation for Bishops, Jean-Louis Torrent, president of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, Camillo Ruini, for many years the vicar general for Rome, and Joseph Tomko, the prefect emeritus of the Evangelization Congregation. And then what the Holy Father is going to do, given that as we speak, of course, the cardinals have been in town all week from different countries to, because 46 archbishops always receive the pallium on June 29th, and many people from their countries are in town for this celebration. So the Pope will also be meeting with those cardinals.
Today there was a big appointment.
Exactly.
An American was named communications advisor.
Well, that's really probably, if you just go to look over the headlines of the week, to tap the word Vatican in on a Google search or something, and you're going to find the news that Greg Burke was appointed senior communications advisor to the Vatican's Secretariat of State, and he will be responsible actually to the number two man in the Secretariat of State. And the news was leaked just a tad earlier than the Vatican's official announcement, but Father Lombardi did confirm the appointment, and he said the goal of this new figure will be to contribute to integrating attention to communication issues within the Secretariat of State and handling relations with the press office and other institutions in charge of communications. Probably the Vatican and Greg Burke together are going to have a certain learning curve, simply because the office is new. Mm. He's not going to be going into an office with an established protocol, staff, et cetera, to the Holy See.
John, moving on to Sunday.
Two, again, newsworthy parts of the Angelus really came at the end. The Pope did talk about the feast of John the Baptist, June 24th. It's a big, big day in Rome, as a matter of fact. And while the Pope did focus for some time on John the Baptist, he also, at the end of his remarks on the Baptist, did talk about the fact that Tuesday he would go to earthquake-struck Emilia-Romagna to symbolize the entire church's solidarity.
Which he did.
He asked people to accompany him with his prayers, and he also noted, by the way, that Sunday marked the Pope's Charity Day, and he thanked all the local church communities, families, and individual worshipers for their ongoing and generous support, which benefits many brothers in trouble. So money comes into the Pope for his charities, and he designates where it goes. So then Tuesday, in an incredibly hot weather, spent several hours in Emilia-Romagna, met earthquake victims, people who had lost their homes and everything else. And in particular, he did stop in front of the Church of St. Catherine of Alexandria in silent prayer. That had partially collapsed, and the very much loved pastor, Father Ivan Martini, died trying to save a statue of Mary. And that statue was on the front steps of the church. The Holy Father stopped before the church and the statue. And actually, that did accompany him on his trip to one or two other stops, especially where he spoke. But in his wonderful words, you could tell how heartfelt the people's gratitude was for his presence. And the Pope assured everybody, said, "You are not alone. You will never be alone." He really indicated that he understood their pain and loss. So a very special day for the Pope, but for the citizens of Emilia-Romagna.
His next big appointment was on Wednesday, as always, no?
Wednesday, of course, the Pope had his general audience, and as I said at the start of the show, this is his last one until August 1st, and the Pope focused on as he's been doing, the letters of St. Paul. This week it was the letter to the Philippians, which the Pope called the great Christological hymn. And I thought some of the more remarkable words were when he stressed that Jesus Christ is the only Lord of our life amidst the many rulers who want to steer and guide it. And that's why we must have a range of values, but God must come first. Even the abbreviated version of this audience, the summary that some of the news agencies have given, they really did seem to stress the important points. It's kind of worth rereading again.
So on Friday, it's a big holiday here in Rome because it's a religious feast day, but it's also a holiday in the city. It's Saints Peter and Paul,
the patron saints of Rome.
And of course, it's going on in the Vatican.
A holiday in the Vatican. And the Pope traditionally confers the pallium on metropolitan archbishops. Now, on June 29th, those who received the pallium are those who've been named metropolitan archbishops since the previous June 29th. And normally, the first one to have been named after June 29th of one year becomes the archbishop who concelebrates the Mass with the Holy Father. Now, there's a change in the pallium ceremony this year, not in the ceremony itself of the Pope conferring the pallium on the bishops as a sign of their authority and their link with the Holy See. It's where this ceremony takes place in the Mass. Normally, it came after the Pope's homily, so it was right in the middle of the Eucharistic celebration. But because the pallium ceremony is not a sacramental, it does not have a sacramental character, they decided to take it out of the middle of Mass, which like becomes then interrupted. You almost forget you're there for Mass. And the entire pallium ceremony will now be at the beginning of Mass. So then when that is done, the 46 archbishops receive their palliums, the Pope begins celebrating Mass, and that goes on uninterrupted. A very notable, important change, which, by the way, the Holy Father approved.
And many thanks there go to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. She'll be back again at the same time next week as well. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.